And tonight we have an out-of-town speaker, which I'm pleased to welcome, Scott R. from Los Angeles.
My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much for having me up. I'm having a great night. I'm just having a great day and a great night. If you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. And I've just been treated with incredible hospitality and kindness. I had a great time at dinner. I've got a lot of friends here tonight. I want to congratulate all the chip takers and the birthday celebrants, a couple of my friends who I really adore. I got to see them take chips. And I'd like to welcome you, if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you catch alcoholism. One of our celebrants tonight said he's got it. I believe him. He looks like an alcoholic. I did not have alcoholism when I came to AA. So if you're new here and you don't believe this business about a disease, I didn't believe it for a long time. I believe it very, very strongly now, but it took me a long time. And I certainly didn't have alcoholism when I got here. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. That's where I got it. The infection enters through the ear, and then you start infecting other people. But I didn't have it. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not because I had alcoholism. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I put a needle in my arm. And the last time I had done that was the night my father died, and I swore I'd never do it again. I just drank for 13 years. I felt like a pig, like an animal, like something less, certainly less than human, the night my old man died and I was loaded on heroin, and I swore I'd never put a needle in my arm again. And I didn't until I did. And that was my bottom, and I don't know why that was my bottom. There's a lot of other days I could have made it okay to do that. I could have just turned the whole world. I love reasons to drink. I adore them. I collect them. One of my favorites was I was sponsoring this guy for about 15 minutes. And he had a wife. He lived with his wife. He had a gay lover, and he was a male prostitute. And he called me and told me that he drank. And I said, oh, why? You gotta ask why. And he, without even missing a beat, he said, I caught my wife cheating on me. That's why he drank. Now, you have to turn the whole world. You have to turn the whole world. You got to turn the whole world. You got to cut and paste reality. You got to turn the whole world so it just drops in slot by slot. I know, okay, I'm a hooker with a beeper. But the bitch cheated on me. I'm out of here. You got to turn the whole world. And why I didn't turn the whole world that morning, I couldn't tell you. I absolutely could not tell you. And I had a legion of reasons why I wasn't an alcoholic. I'm Jewish. Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. And you certainly don't want to squander any agony opportunity. And you know, it's funny, because one of the first guys that saved my life in AA was this old guy who used to say, in my first meeting I used to attend, he said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means I don't believe in God, and I'm positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I said, I'm sitting next to him, man, because I understand that absolutely. I also could not possibly have been alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I am not putting therapy down in any way, shape, or form. I've used therapy plenty in sobriety with my family, myself and my wife, myself individually. I got no beef against therapy. I have no malpractice insurance, so I'm not in the habit of telling people what to do in that area. My colossal blunder is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife once a week and just getting these colossal ass poundings, you know. I mean, the idea of therapy, of conventional Freudian-based therapy, is to uncover, discover, and apply, to free associate, to maybe delve into your past. And if you're neurotic, if you don't have pathology, if you're just a neurotic, I don't know if anybody here has ever been told they're neurotic, but to be a neurosis is you have anxiety, right? You have anxiety, and then you come up with a solution for the anxiety that creates more anxiety. It's your solutions are worse than your problems. I don't know if that resonates for anybody here. So the idea of therapy is to come up with a better resolution for my anxiety. So I'm not neurotics, but I've got alcoholism. So I come into therapy, I go, I feel terrible. Why? I was so drunk this afternoon, I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? Let's talk about it. Want to talk about it? Hey, I got an idea. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. I feel terrible. Why? Well, this afternoon I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a matchbox striker and sucked some heroin up through a fluffed up cigarette filter and slammed. I feel terrible. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. How are you going to treat nothing? How do you treat nothing? How do you treat the room spun, my brain got too big for my skull, my mouth filled with saliva, I went out for a pack of cigarettes and wound up in Baltimore. How do you treat that? You can't treat that. My alcoholism is too efficient. It generates insanity at such a horrific rate. You would need a board of shrinks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to catch my shit, to file it, to put it in a file and put it on a shelf, just to stay up with me. So therapy didn't work out well for me. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. To a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And they're an extremely troubled group of people. My mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it, so the bun was bouncing off her forehead all night. And it was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after. She wore it sort of jauntily askew, sort of beret style. And my wife walked around as if she had been struck by a stone the entire night. I mean, I had not exaggerated the problem. Believe me, I was trying to soften the blow. They're insane. My uncle used to steal bales of steel wool from his job. He was a welder. And my aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled them all with the free steel wool, which works its way through on you after a while. So, like when you were at their house, everybody was moving a little bit. You know, everybody, whole room was like a pulsing, breathing organism. And if you're new, I've injured that woman. She's injured. If you're new, all I've got is good news for you, because my family didn't have anything to do with making me an alcoholic. And I'm telling you, there was a lot of really bad stuff. There was mental and physical abuse, chronic institutionalization in the state institutions in New York, which grasslands and places like that, which were bad. You went into the back rooms of grasslands, the odds of you getting out were very, very slim. I had family members back there, and a lot of violence, a lot of insanity, and they didn't make me an alcoholic. And I am not telling you they didn't injure me. I was terribly injured. And I'm not telling you I haven't had to do a lot of stuff about that. I have. I still am. But I'm telling you they didn't make me a drunk. If you're new, I have a physical allergy that makes it impossible for me to moderate once I start drinking. I can't. If you're special and a drug addict, welcome to AA. If you're a dope fiend was like kind of worse than any of us. Welcome. And I'd like to welcome all the tweakers here tonight. I'm very excited. Yeah, there you go. Hey. Welcome. If you've ever masturbated until you're dehydrated, welcome to AA. Special. If you've ever licked all the features off your own face, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you guys. You stay quick for a while. And every part of their face is moving in a different direction. You're special. I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming close, I know, but I'll tell you, I'm really not, and I'll tell you why. I don't care what you've got. I don't care if you're like a crack monster or, you know, a dope-sniffing energizer bunny. I don't give a crap. Just catch alcoholism. Catch it. We'd love to give it to you. And again, I didn't have it when I got here. I didn't get it. You know, I can't control or moderate once I begin. And if you're a drug addict and special, try some controlled crack smoking. You know, just fill your mouth up with crack smoke, say I'm not in the mood and blow it out. And hats will fill the air. We'll elect you president. And that would be okay. If it was a physical problem, it'd be all right. The problem is I have this bizarre thinking. I have this weird thinking that keeps driving me to take a drink I can't stop taking. And I still have the thinking. That's why I do more in AA 19 years in than I've ever done before. And the guys who I hang out with do more. The guys who I hang out with do more when things get good, and they do more when things get bad. They do more because I still have this thinking. And what happens is my alcoholism used to go below the horizon and stop presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I would drink again. Certain things could happen at certain periods of time that would keep it buoyed above it for a short period of time. Something in my family, something with my children, you know. But it was inexplicable of what forced it below the horizon, you know. And I still have that kind of thinking, and that's why I treat it. I was about 14, 15 years sober, and I was told I needed surgery on my hand. And this doctor said, you know, Mr. Redmond, you're going to need general anesthetic. I'm 14 years sober. I said, general anesthetic, that's great. That's great. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. There's no normal person that goes, oh, general anesthetic. But I do, and I'll tell you why. Because when they hit you with general anesthetic, they say count backwards from 100. And you go, 100, 99, I love 99. I love 99. Also, I leave out the surgery. I leave out the surgery. I go from announcement to loaded. I leave out the surgery. I leave out the whole middle. So 2 years ago, I'm about 17 years sober, I go to another doctor. He said, you know, you're going to need the same surgery you had on your left hand, on your right hand. And I said, I guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic. And this doctor says, you don't need general anesthetic with that surgery. And my first thought was, no, I need another goddamn doctor. That's what I need. Let's get a doctor 5.0 going here, man. Let's upgrade this sucker. But I won't chase it anymore. I won't chase 99 anymore. I won't do it. I won't settle for a nickel today when I could have a quarter tomorrow. You know, if you're new here, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism. I've heard wacky stuff about alcoholism ever since I came into AA. And some of it works for me and some of it doesn't. The stuff that annoys me, damned if I could find any of it in the big book of AA. And some of it works for some people. It just doesn't. Some of it doesn't work for me. I have heard that alcoholics don't like change. I don't like change I don't like. But I'm nuts about change I like. I've never heard an alcoholic get to a podium and say, oh, I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me. I can't stand change. I've also heard alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm a pig. I am not a perfectionist. I have explosions of perfectionism when my wife is caring for me. That's when I seem to have this huge eruption of perfectionism. My personal favorite is I've heard alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting, ever. Ever. And one of the most misquoted lines in the big book of AA for me is I've heard people say, my worst day in here is better than my best day out there. Oh, I don't think so. Let's see, a pound of cocaine in an all-female jazz band or a panel at the prison. I don't know. What do you want to do? What the big book says is I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day in, because I won't chase 99 anymore. I won't trade this way of life in. I won't be a sucker anymore. I won't be a sap. I get that. But I had a great time out there. I had a fantastic time. I really love the drinking. And I'm nuts about the drugs. I always have been since I'm a little kid. I grew up in the Bronx in this insane family. I didn't know that I had this physical allergy right away, and I had this bizarre thinking that kept driving me to take this drink I couldn't stop taking, and I developed this cancer of the soul from a pretty early age, starting when I was about 12, 13 years old. I started stealing stuff and joined a gang, which I was thrown out of. Being brought in this gang, we used to steal Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes and drive them into each other and get drunk. This was a real summa cum laude group. And I'm being ushered into this group by this guy, George. I'm in a circle of guys, and George says, look, the ignition's on a column. If it's on off, just take your house key, put it in, and turn it on and drive off, because you can do that. If it's on lock, shine the car, get another car. And I looked on, I said, what if it's on? He said, then someone's in the car, you moron. And so I went and applied. The hippies were recruiting across the street, and there was no test. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? Wow. Wow. And right after WOW usually came, what? What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. They can't get a claw in the rug. I kicked that gall darn marijuana with pills, and I tramped over pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I overcame that gall darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. And then you cross an invisible line and become a vomiting pig. I don't mean to piss anybody off talking about drugs. I'm just telling my story, and I really did not come up here to annoy anyone. And if it annoys you, talk to Chris. Because as a matter of fact, if my story pisses you off at all, talk to Chris. And sometimes people come up to thank me. And one time a guy walked up to me after talking. He says, why do you hate AA? And I thought, I don't. I hate you. I love AA. You're pissing me off right now. So any straightening out, Chris is taking all those notes tonight. He's ready for you. had a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. I sold heroin to a New York City policeman. He cheated. He wasn't wearing a uniform. It was incredible. I had this poignant memory tonight. Because of something we were talking about earlier. But I'd been popped for selling smack to a cop. I'm being taken into the Bronx County Courthouse on a 25-foot long chain. There's a foot, 2 feet, guy, cuff. And they used to let this old woman with a huge wooden crucifix around her neck because the cops loved her. And as you'd walk by her, she'd go, God bless y'all. Y'all going to the electric chair this morning. Y'all going to die today. And some of the guys were going to the electric chair. And you could tell them because they'd scream and drop to their knees, a couple of the guys. And I remember being on this chain and one guy started erupting in terror. And I'm going, what a loser, you know. At any rate, I was in my early 20s. I had slammed some dope. My father had a massive stroke, and I couldn't show up for him the night that he died, and I swore I would never put a needle in my arm again. And I didn't. I didn't. Shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play, and I met a new usherette with long brown hair. I took one look at her, and I didn't even talk to her, and I told all the guys in the cast that if they talked to her, I'd kill them. And we celebrated 28 years of marriage last week. In part, because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time, which you guys know. And in part, because we've stuck together and we've reached out to a power greater than ourselves and stayed married one day at a time. And we started our life together. We had a great time living in New York in our early 20s. I was acting on Broadway. We had a great time. Our older son was born, and he was really welcomed into our world. We were surrounded by friends and family and had a ton of phone calls. And just 2 years and 9 months later, when my son Jesse was born, there was nobody around, no phone calls, no family. We were so isolated by the disease of alcoholism that no one showed up at the hospital. It was gruesome. How did such a thing happen? How did our lives become this tiny, painful wound? You know? And the doctor called me that night, a doctor I had never met before, and said, Mr. Redman, your wife is in extreme psychological duress. She's completely isolated here. And you know, on a maternity ward, there's all this great stuff going around. And when you're out of the loop, you're out of the loop. Jesse got sick. He was in neonatal intensive care. And this doctor said to me, where are you? And I said, you know what? I can't find anyone to watch my two-year-old son. And she said to me that night, you know, my husband's home. I had never met her before. This is a doctor at a big metropolitan hospital. My husband's home. I'll give you my phone number and my address, and you can take your two-year-old to my hospital to take care of him. And I said, no. I had no way to accept this woman's generosity. And now my poor son Micah had to be locked in the house with me. I would have done better to take him down and leave him with a coloring book in the waiting room. At least he could have gotten away from me. And, you know, Bill, in his story, he describes this horrible life, that he had been the architect of. And at the end of his description of being too cowardly to drink poison, of dragging his mattress down from an upper floor because he was afraid to pitch himself out, of waiting for his wife to come home so he could steal money from her purse, of being an unwanted hanger-on at places that he used to be a successful businessman, of begging for credit at the local deli so he could have a beer. And then he says, little were we to know. Well, little were we to know. This was going to continue for 2 years and 9 months. This horrible life, you know. And my son Micah came to me when he was 5 years old. A Christian family had moved in next to us, and their kid used to talk about God a lot. And my son Micah came to me at five, and he said to me, Dad, is there anything such as God? And I looked into the eyes of my perfect five-year-old baby boy, and I said, no. It's extraordinary. I said, no. I didn't want him to be played like a sap or a sucker. I wanted to give him the real existential party line, something every five-year-old is famished for. And I lied to him. I basically stood in the face, as our gorgeous book says, in the face of all this immutable law, of all this underlying poetry and intelligence, and I said, it's a pointless cipher wandering nowhere. What's worse, much, much worse, in the vocabulary of childhood, what I basically told this little boy was, you know, when you're all alone and you're scared and you can't go to sleep, tough, because that's all there is. He should have been taken from me. I don't really think there's much worse information and a bigger lie that you can give to a kid. And I didn't get sober for another year. My wife had become very, very troubled by the time we got here on April 22nd, 1985. We became so sick that at one time a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car? That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow. What do you mean you sold my car?" But I know how I sold this car. It's for the same reason that I got excited when I was told that I needed dental surgery. Dental surgery. Oh, man. I leave out the surgery. I leave out the whole middle. I looked at my wife, said, we didn't have the rent. I said, "Honey, I am so sick of being a punk, irresponsible kid. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's not borrow money. Let's sell the car." And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do." I go from "let's do the right thing, pay rent." I leave out Grand Theft Auto. I leave out the whole middle. I leave out forging the signature on the pink slip. I leave out the whole thing. If you're new here, welcome to the middle. We started out on Broadway together, and I'll tell you how we finished up. This is a good night in the Redmond home, a couple of months before I got sober. I got into an accident that took me to the hospital, and my blood pressure was like the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It was like about 160 over 110. They said, "You know, Mr. Redmond, you're going to have a stroke. You need to lose weight. We need to bring your blood pressure down." And I said, "You know what? I would like to do that, but I drink alcohol and smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night, so I'm not going to be able to." And the doctor said, "Let's prescribe some medication for you." And I said, "What a country." And he prescribed for me chloral hydrate. A chloral hydrate is a fast-acting narcotic knockout drop. It's a Mickey. And I love these pills. I love, love, love my knockout drops. So Nancy comes home. I'm eating handfuls of knockout drops and slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop, because you don't want to squander a perfectly good knockout drop. And I keep eating these pills until I just seize and keel over. And now I'm going to bed. And now I'm incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old men in America, because I got so much Mickey in me. And one night I got up and wet the wall. And everyone was excited the next day. My wife was excited. He wet the wall. He's headed towards the bathroom. You know, this is progress. It's not perfection. We got some movement here. Today the wall, tomorrow the bathroom. She made me a big breakfast. I ate it. I puked it up. And wow. Can I have another cup? I still can't drink successfully. I owe him money. That's why he's doing this. By the time I got sober on April 22nd, 1985, our children were shattered. They were 6 and 3. Their small motor skills were screwed up from, and there was nothing organically wrong with them. They were just so scared all the time and so disrupted they couldn't put small tasks together. My younger son couldn't stop pretending that he was a robot. He couldn't stop. And the conceit was that it was just, "Thanks so much. You don't have to clean up after me now. Come back when you're thanking me. I can't talk while you're down there. It's too scary for me. I'm going to wind up back in therapy. I feel very intimate right now." Do you sponsor him? You do. I love this meeting. I didn't know. I hadn't read our book. I hadn't read the second and third chapters. I hadn't read about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. And our family was shattered. My kids were functionally retarded. My wife was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot. And I was dying. My life had run out between my fingers like a handful of water over and over again. I was unemployable. And on April 22nd, 1985, I put a needle in my arm again. I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I did not ever want to be the guy who couldn't stay sober the night that his old man died. And that day I did it. And why I didn't make it okay to do it, I can't tell you. It's an absolute and complete mystery to me. I called my therapist in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist, and I told him what I had done, and he said to me pretty much the exact same thing that Carl Jung told the man who 12-stepped the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. I didn't know it at the time, but I found it out after I read our literature, and it really made me feel good. Because Carl Jung told this American millionaire who couldn't, he's coming again to clean up more. It's... I think this is a problem for you with the water. The new pastor can't see the water. All right. I'm being stalked now, all right? We're way over the line here. And I'm holding you personally responsible, Chris. All right. If he tries to get back up here, I'm asking for some help. If he comes back here with some Murphy soap, I want to smack him around and take him outside. And he said to me that morning, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. I can't help you. And I said, what? He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is that we institutionalize you. And then he said to me something that Carl Jung couldn't tell Roland Hazard. He said, or you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. And why I went to the AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. It's a complete mystery to me. Why I didn't make it okay to shoot dope again. I don't know why. Why I didn't go to the institution. I don't know why. A lot of other days I would have gone to the institution. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I got my best clothes on. I went to a place called Unit A in the San Fernando Valley. I walked into this club, and I looked around, and I said to myself, oh, my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. And the room looked like it was the product of like 200 years of inbreeding to me, you know? There were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room, as far as I was concerned, you know? It was unbelievable, you know? And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. Oh, the furniture and the coffee are miracles, too. It's a miracle. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to break out. I know that's going to start, right? Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. This will be fun. I always wanted to run a big buck Jew. Come on, we'll knock his beanie off. When he bends over to pick it up, we'll push him over. It'll be fun. And then the AA unsolicited information guy, he saw me after the meeting. You know him. He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Huh? Do I want what you've got? Yeah. No. No. But thanks for spitting on me. I appreciate it. Thanks, Clyde. See you next week. You gonna hook a rug next week? When does the arts and crafts start? I mean, I was horrified. Horrified. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And I tell you, I swear to you, I was out of plans. I mean, I think that's why I did it. I was out of plans. I didn't wake up in the morning and say, let's see Clem and Martha, you know. Oh, God. I was out of plans. And if you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. You know it well. You're a port city. I'm not going to tell him I got my jacket wet. I'll get blow dried up here, for God's sake. And I stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months, and my wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and got a sponsor, who's my lovely Ruby, who is still Nancy's sponsor today, who I just adore. And we were broken. My kids were very, very troubled and very sick. I was just psychotic. And you told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We just stayed the hell away from each other. I had nothing to bring to my marriage. I didn't know how to fight. I didn't know how to fight good. I would either scream until she shut up, or I would cry until she shut up. Either one's fine. I have always loved the tyranny of helplessness. And I'm a loomer. I like to loom. I'm big. I like to loom with a light behind me. I like to get her in a shadow, right? It's like total eclipse of the Jew if I get her, like, right in there, right? And if I can, like, work a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick. It doesn't get a whole lot better than that. These are my relationship skills. Here, I'll give you the Scott Redman Couples Workshop right now. 11 seconds. Here, you ready? Talk to her until she changes her mind. Talk to her until her eyes roll back in her head, she keels over, and on the way over, she goes, oh, okay. That's what I'm bringing to the deal. I'm a pig. I don't clean up after myself. I don't feel like a grown man. I've never have. Not until I came into AA and found out grown men make their bed. But I don't think that. I think somewhere in the back of my really troubled mind that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. I'm still looking for that bottle. Never saw that on Martha Stewart either. At any rate, I'm bringing nothing to the deal. Nancy and I really had to stay away from each other. And I was 6 months sober. I was getting sicker and sicker from untreated alcoholism. And I knew I was going to drink because I had seen the AA drill hundreds of times here. And I asked the guy to sponsor me. And, you know, we had so many insane rules in our house with our children. My kids weren't allowed to eat sugar, watch TV, or cuss. So my wife would give him granola for breakfast and put him in the car with me, Dr. Death, and say, hope you live, but you've had a hearty breakfast. And we're just insane. And she would take the boys over to Ruby's house, and Ruby would give him a big bowl of M&Ms, turn the TV on to the Love Boat, sit him down. And Milton one day, who was sober a long time then, called the boys over one day, and he bent down and he said, boys, your parents don't know shit. And my kids went, oh my God, we suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is fantastic. And he cursed, and we're eating M&Ms, and we're watching the Love Boat. They were in heaven. We were made out of wood. We were made out of cardboard. We made a terrible hollow sound when you hit us. And you guys pried our jaws open, and you spit life into us. You lightened us up. And I got an incredible sponsor when I was 6 months sober, and he showed me the steps, and he started me in the work because I didn't want to. And I consider myself fortunate to have stayed sober for 6 months before I started the work, because I found AA a very troublesome and confusing place, although I knew I had no, you know. If you're new, I want to congratulate you if you're not drinking, for having this opportunity, this window of opportunity. Sometimes we get a little crazy because we get anxious for you to take advantage of the opportunity, because we see these opportunities disappear sometimes so quickly. We see these little portals of opportunity of not drinking, of being out of the cycle of spree and remorse, and sometimes we get very excited wanting you to arm yourself or try to do as much as you can, take as much action you can. And you know what? Faith without works is dead, but works without faith are dead. And after a while, my activity in AA can become a hollow endeavor if it's not tethered to a spiritual endeavor. And these things balance themselves. So if you're new, I want to congratulate you, and I want to urge you to do whatever. If your alcoholism is being kept above the horizon as a real piece of business, I want to congratulate you and urge you to take advantage of that opportunity as much as I can. The not drinking part is a moose. If it wasn't for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. There's no question about it. because that not drinking part really screws a lot of people up. And but here's the weird thing. If you're new and you want to drink, don't. It's the wackiest thing I ever heard. It really is. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we're basically suggesting to you that you stop treating your craving with a drink, that you accept the craving, take the whooping, so that you'll become available for the treatment here and the removal of the obsession. Take the whooping. You know, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. You know. And we made a beginning in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started working the steps with my sponsor. I gave him the instructions in the fourth step when I was 6 months sober. I went back, I read it to him at 9 months sobriety, and I did step six and seven for the first time. It came time to do my eight-step list. And I try to share this anytime I talk. It's the best reading of the eight-step I've ever heard, and I heard it at my old home group, and it was from a guy named Nino. I was a couple of weeks sober. I'd never seen the guy before. I've never seen him again. He had a heavy New York accent. He had never read Chapter 5 before. He was at this meeting with Hospital Plastic On with a hospital group. And he got up to Step 8 and he read to this group of men, made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen this? Do you know what the hell is in here? It was so beautiful. It was so perfect. It was the most, it was the purest reading because it was like he had been struck by a stone. And if you're new here, it's the only thing I saw on the list when I came in. Not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back, right? Think I'm an idiot? And if you're new, don't worry about it. It's eight steps from where you are anyway. And eight's really not the annoying one. It's nine. Yeah. It's really. So I wrote my eight step list up. My kids and my dad and my wife were down there, and anybody who I had ever worked for, because I was a thief. And I didn't know what I was going to do about my wife and my kids. I could not possibly sit down and apologize to them. I'm sorry were the two most useless words in my vocabulary. It was like having a mouthful of ashes. And what a terrible burden to place on my two little sons, to sit them down and make some sort of demonstrative verbal apology to them. It would have been awful. And I didn't know what to do, and I was graced with a sponsor who refused to tell me. He wouldn't tell me. He wouldn't give me a series of chores to do. He said, do your job. Do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous and see what happens. Do your job. And I started doing my job in AA. I addressed my inventory as my spiritual task. I had to go into my kids' school and advocate for my kids and sit down with teachers and say, who were telling me, because my kids had so much potential. Tested in excess of 150 IQ and could barely read or write, reading years below their grade level, couldn't put small tasks together. And this teacher said to me, sometimes I want to grab him and shake him. And I said to this teacher, you know what? He's all shook. He's all shook. We've been terribly sick. My kids have been sick from living with me. I've been terribly ill. We're making a beginning. Can you help us? And not once has anyone said no. Never has happened. Every time they've said, sure, let's test the boys. Let's see what's going on. You know, and the boys tested and they needed help and they got great resources. My friend David and I were talking earlier. My kids have received these two remarkable educations. And my son Jesse wound up on a full scholarship to Chicago University on physics. And this was a kid who couldn't stop pretending he was a robot. He's making the goddamn things now. we made a beginning. We really started, and again, Nancy and I really had to really back off and stay away from each other. And the shame and the guilt I felt about this stuff was unbelievable, and it stayed with me for quite a while. I think I was about a year or two sober. Micah was about 8 years old, and I was making the boys lunch, and I said to Mike, what do you want on your hot dog? And he said to me, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. And I looked at him, I said, lettuce? He said, yeah, I don't want lettuce. And he walked away from me, and he came back about 45 minutes later, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said to me, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. So I asked him to sponsor me with that pair. What's that? What is that? A couple of years after this, Michael was 10, Jesse was about 7, and Jesse got injured in a schoolyard accident. He broke his wrist, and he broke it in a growth plane, which, if you know about kids, is cartilage that's going to turn to bone. If it gets disrupted, it's very important that it gets set and that it get left alone. And he's a younger brother. It comes home with a cast, which for a younger brother is a weapon, and it's a fantastic thing. It really gives you an edge for as long as it's on, you know, and he's very happy about this. He thinks he should always have one, and they're, you know, beating the crap out of each other 10 minutes after, and I really had to impress the boys. They couldn't do it. It had to, and I had to tell Micah, this is not something I can repeat 11 times. It can't happen. And finally, I had to yell at him, and I got up in his face, and I yelled at him and put a lid on it. And he walked away from me, and he walked into his room, and he slammed the door. Slammed the door. So I got the dad tick going now. Slammed the door. So I go to the door, and I open the door, and before I can unload on him, he says, hold it. I didn't say you were wrong out there. You were right. But a big guy just got in my face and screamed and yelled. I didn't tell you you were wrong. Don't tell me I can't be mad. What is that? That's the touch of the master's hand. That's grace. That's overcoming a fear of confrontation and telling somebody how you feel without telling them what to do and asking for the same treatment. That's taking no shit and giving no shit. That's a design for living. That's remarkable. I know how to retaliate. I know how to scream and yell and loom. I know how to do that. I know how to repress and then climb into a clock tower with a high-powered rifle. I know how to do that. But to stand up for myself and tell you how I feel without playing God with you, that is grace to me. And I learned it from my sons. I had a terrible thing with my kids. I felt so ashamed and guilty about these terrible lives they had led. And when they would start to fight, I'd pull them apart. I'd pull them apart, and they would continue to fight, and I'd get angry. And my wife said to me, you never let them finish. I said, what? He said, you don't let them finish, which is exactly the description of what I was doing in my marriage. How many times in my marriage do we start fighting again? And I go, weren't we just here like 10 minutes ago? Is this some kind of cosmic joke? Why do we keep winding up in the same place? And the fact is I would scream or cry and wouldn't finish the fight. I didn't know how to fight. I didn't know how to finish. And I learned by letting my kids finish. And it was physically painful for me. I stopped pulling them apart. I trusted they wouldn't kill each other. And I let them finish. And what an incredibly powerful lesson. And I started doing it in my marriage. I would start screaming or start crying, and my wife would go, and she would just stay with it, you know. In my wife's Al-Anon family, they're encouraged when things get a little dicey, you know, when they start spinning a little bit, she was encouraged to say, you know, honey, you could be right. And we were in the car one day, and it started, we getting a lot of movement. Things started moving pretty quick. And when she started pressing on the imaginary brake on her side, I think that's when it really getting lit up. And she said, you know, sweetheart, you could be right, but not today. I found that in my marriage, the more I do inventory, the defect that has plagued me, I think as much if not more than anything, is the defect of mind reading. My notion that I think that I know what my wife is thinking or what she meant when she said a certain thing is terrifying. My wife has said to me, you're not a mind reader, you're barely a mind user. which I thought was very insensitive. And I'm sure your mind skills are much, much better honed than mine. At any rate, I really did start addressing my inventory as my spiritual task, and my kids got in a special ed, and the special ed teacher said, you know, let's see if some big motor stuff will help the small motor stuff. And she said, get him into music, get him into sports. So I spent a couple of dope dollars buying him a mitt. I had never registered him for the Little League. We'd become so uncivilized. It was just absolutely remarkable. And Jesse wanted to play drums, and I didn't have any dough. So I went to the music store and got him a drum pad, which is a piece of wood with a piece of rubber and a couple of sticks. That's what I could afford. But you know what? My kid wanted something, and I backed him up. And I went to my home group. And if your home group's like my home group, you'll understand this. I told the guys what I'd done because I was proud of it. My kid had asked me for something, and I had done something about it. And the other reason why I told them is because my home group was interested in me. They were interested in my family. They were rooting for us. And within 3 weeks or so, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were a lot of burnout drummers in my group at that time. And guys are showing up with these Megadeth drums and dude. And Jesse had this drum set. He would literally disappear when he sat behind the drum set. He was such a little boy at the time. And a couple of years ago, my kids played the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip in L.A., and they burnt the dump down. They burnt it down. They were playing music to this packed house, 800-900 kids playing hip-hop music, and burnt the dump down. And there's this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics standing over to the side, you know. The kids are going, what is with the crying old people, man? What the hell is that? Uncles that have been following them around for the past 19 years. They're playing a club in L.A. tonight, and I couldn't be there because I'm doing the most important thing in my life. And I really, I would have liked to have been there, but it doesn't matter. They'll have a great time. They'll record it, and they'll play it for me. And, you know, a couple of years ago, this guy, my son Micah, was babysitting for this couple in the program, and this guy said to him, what do you think of your old man talking in AA? And Micah said, you know, I'm not a member. I don't really give a crap about that. He said, all I can tell you, since I'm a very, very little boy, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have taken very, very good care of me, and never once has any of them demanded that I believe in what they believe. Yikes. How remarkable. What a gorgeous thing to say about a group of people involved in a spiritual endeavor, especially in this time of so much spiritual propriety. We've seen so much of spiritual tools used as spiritual weapons. What a gorgeous compliment and testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? My kids are doing remarkably well. And, you know, my son graduated high school. Micah, decided to go to Chiapas, Mexico to work with the Zapatista revolutionaries for a while. And I was terrified. I mean, absolutely terrified. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was beside myself. The Mexican military is depicted as such a group of kind and loving. They're the we care people in Mexico. and I would just have this bad Oliver Stone movie, you know, going through my head. And, you know, whatever your politics are, that's not about this. I will tell you this. My son did more in that moment than I did through the entire 60s. I just talked a lot of crap and couldn't find my way out of the bathroom. And and he's there throwing, you know, he's there, groups of Westerners in the jungle, in villages, there to bear witness to make sure the Mexican military doesn't abuse indigenous peoples. And he's out in the jungle for 3 weeks at a pop, and I can't hear from him. And I'm having these waves of fear coming in me, and they're killing me. And my sponsor, God bless him, said to me, "Why? I don't think you're going to be able to handle the Mexican military. I'm going to suggest that in the morning when you do your walk, that you take the first three steps and you turn the Mexican military over to God." And I started doing that, and it really worked beautifully for me. And one morning, it didn't. the waves came in faster than the prayer went out, and it just beat me to a pulp. And I got on the Paul on the phone with Paul, and I just was weeping. And he did the thing we're told to do. We're told to do it over and over again. Don't fight with a drunk. Don't. What is he going to say? No, it's not scary down there. No, he'll be okay. No, you're being dramatic. Kiss my ass. I said that to myself, but I did say it. And what he said to me was something so gorgeous. He said to me, maybe this is the greatest thing Michael will ever do in his life. And he didn't say the next thing to me, which is, why would you take that away from him? Why would you wish? Now, I don't know if it's the greatest thing that he'll ever do in his life, but he came back from that trip fully cut cloth. He went off to school. I mean, he came back. He had to go to Osh, the hardware store, to get something. My wife said, geez, you think he can do it? I said, well, he's done Chiapas. I think he'll do Osh. I think we'll be fine. I'm not telling you if you're new. I'm just telling you what's happening in my house. That's just what's happening in my house. Years ago, we were in the epicenter of the Northridge earthquake. We really got injured. Our house got cracked up, and we got hurt real bad. And shortly after the quake, we were at an AA function in Canada, and a woman came up to me who used to live in Los Angeles, and she said to me, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you. But we're crap. But he likes you. That's so great. And she said to me, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out, babe. I'm out. I can't live in that world for 2 seconds. I cannot live in a world when I've got a God saying, get him. Get the Redmond boy. Get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. Get him. Turn his wife to salt. Kill his goat. Put a finger in his eye. Get him. Smote his ass. Smote him. Smote anyone he talks to. Kill them all. We'll figure it out later. It's a mystery. Figure it out. Get back to me when you figure it out. There's a reason for this. Possibly, I can't live in that world where I've got a God saying, let's key your car. It's boils for you. You're due for a rash, don't you think? I can't live in a world with a baby annihilator. It's not my world. My God expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if it's to show a guy how to stay sober through the annihilation of a child or showing up at the House of Blues and seeing him play. My God's not killing children. If I saw the deliberate hand of God in the suffering of people, I'm out. I believe in the big book. I believe St. Thomas. I believe the mystics, that God is absolute and complete mystery. And when I ascribe a personality or an intent to him, my life gets this small. It's a mystery. That's hard. And I've made that mistake in AA because I can't stop drinking, but I stopped drinking. So I stopped drinking with those people. So it must be those people, right? It must be those people. It must be that group. If I have to quit AA to join my home group, I don't want to be part of it. I don't, you know. And that's been a great relief for me over these years. I used to sponsor a guy named Mike. Mike was a working guy. When he got sober, he was living on the floor of his coke dealer's house. And he got sober, and my group was very excited about these guys. One of these guys who just comes from absolutely a ruinous bottom. And he started putting a life together. And he stayed sober for a while, a year or two. And I used to pick him up for our home group every week. And he gets in the car, and he said, I met a girl 6 weeks ago, news to me. And she's pregnant, and we want to get married and have the kid. And what do you think? And I took a deep breath, and I didn't really have to think about it at all. I turned to him, and I said, it didn't matter what I thought. I said, what do you need me to do? You need, if you don't want the baby and you want help, I'll give you help. If you want me to show up and be the best man at your wedding, I will. Now, please don't take anything I do as a suggestion or as an indictment of what you do. Would I have done that to all the guys I sponsor? I don't know. All the guys didn't ask me. He asked me, and I knew that guy, and I followed my heart because I didn't resent the guy, and I didn't need to do. I'm not going to explain that. I'm just telling you what happened. And the group was excited about this and excited about the baby. And we had a baby shower for him, and the baby got born and was incredibly sick. She was born at home. She was dying. She was rushed to the hospital and put on an ECMO machine, which is an incredibly intrusive thing where a baby's heart is actually attached to a machine. It's got to put oxygen in the baby and bring it back in. And this is the reason why I'm telling you this. The reason why I'm telling you this is that we went back to the group. The guys threw $900 in the basket because he's a working guy and he's got to be with his family. Because that's what we do. That's what many of us do. And we went down, now to go in neonatal intensive care, you've got to be a member of the family. So now members of the family are showing up. 6'6" Ethiopian men, small Asian women, overweight Jewish men. And the nurses after a while said, don't pause to lie, just go in, you know. They needed blood. So most of us can't get blood because we either have fresh ink or we're ex-hypes, but we go down so they can reject us and we can get pissed off, right? And 2 weeks after the baby was home and healthy, the hospital called Mike and said, they're still coming with blood, man. They're dropping it off in jars, for God's sake, you know? Tell them to stop. That marriage didn't make it. That baby and those relationships, those parents are not together. They're bringing the baby up brilliantly. She's a 10-year-old girl now. She's just in fantastic shape. You can still see the little ECMO scar on her neck. And if I had somehow thought that it was my providence to slam the door on that, who the hell am I? Who the hell am I to stop this incredible demonstration? You know? And I don't think God... I think Mike did his job. He was there to show a guy how to stay sober no matter what happened. A couple of years ago, a guy who I sponsor called me up and he said, you know, we're going to have our second baby tonight. And I'm going to bring my 3-year-old son. Could I bring him over to your house? Could you take care of him? And my son, Jesse, who was the kid who I couldn't show up for the night he got born, took care of that baby with me that night. So our friend Tarefa and his wife could have their child. And I told Jesse the story of the night that he was born that night. And we lulled that baby to sleep until he went to bed. And about 5 years ago, I took out my 8-step list and I opened it up and I saw my son's name on it and I crossed him off. It wasn't an event. It was time. We're done. We're current, you know. If you're new here, I don't know the dark hole that you're coming in with. I don't know the thing that when it gets mentioned, you feel like you're getting hit by a brick. I do know that I've seen, you know, if you've strangled a puppy, we got a guy who has strangled 2 puppies, you know. It's a remarkable thing. I was in my first year and I started sponsoring a guy named Roland. I still sponsor him. I've sponsored the guy for 18 years. And... he used to call my house every night and he'd leave a message on my answering machine. And he'd say, Scott, this is Roland. I love you. I'm sober. Good night. And he'd hang up the phone. About 5 years later, when I was 6 years sober, my son Micah came to me and he said to me, you know, Dad, I really should tell you that when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the phone. And once I heard Roland's voice on the phone, I could go to bed. And I think sometimes Micah would stay up till he passed out because he was so scared. But this he knew. He knew Roland wouldn't call me if I was drinking. That he knew. And this is the kid who I told there was no God to. I try to rip God out of his life, and Roland came in over the phone and tucked him in every night. Roland's Cuban, and he doesn't understand American sports. And he calls me in the last seconds of any playoff game. So before the Super Bowl starts, Micah calls him and says, can we get this over with now? If you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. The good news is that our problem mainly rests in our mind. There is no recovery from a fatal illness that I know of. The text for recovery that would contain the sentence, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about cholera that says cholera is a hoot. You'll love cholera. You'll meet people who just caught cholera. And you'll meet... My sponsor, Paul, used to say that AA was the only recovery from a fatal illness that he knew of that left the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. That's pretty remarkable. And the bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, I was at a meeting, and I met a new guy, and I came home, and he called me, and he talked to me for an hour. I said, uh-huh, four times, so you'd know I wasn't dead. And he explained to me that he had been stalking several women, but he's 2 weeks sober now, and he's got some restraining orders out against him, but it's all different now. And at the end of the hour, he said to me, I feel so alone. And I said, well, what are you talking about? I hardly know you. I've just listened to you for an hour without interrupting. What do you mean you feel alone? And he said, well, I don't have a woman. And I said to him, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party right now? People 2 weeks into leukemia are not having dating problems. Alcoholics are, because our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, my wife knew I was talking to a newcomer, and she heard me saying to the phone, let's say the aliens are coming. And she stopped short. She ain't missing a word of this. I said, look, man, I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. That's an outside interest. They might very well be coming. But I have one question. Why you? Why have they come for you? Why have they traversed the universe for your sorry ass? Why have they come across a galaxy? And plus, he's sleeping with a Bible on his chest to ward them off. So they're going to come across the galaxy, walk into his room, and go, oh, no, the Bible, let's go home. Why? Why you? So I was telling this at my home group, and the guy in the story walked into my home group, and I'm watching the cat, and I'm telling this story, and the guy's listening to the story, and I see him go like this. Oh, 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 shit. Oh. If you're new, I want to share a miracle with you. It's a miracle. It's just a miracle. And this is the miracle. My alcoholism in 19 years has never gone below the horizon and stopped presenting itself as a real piece of business, even when I'm not focusing on it, even when I'm not concentrating on it, because it's buoyed on the shoulders of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and the higher power that's expressed in the group conscience. It's a miracle. It's a grand, grand miracle. If you're new here, I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. If the aliens are coming for you, welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks for having me.